From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in January 2005 with the publication of a book called The China Study. It examined the relationship between the consumption of animal-based products and deadly illnesses such as heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. And the authors, including Colin Campbell, advocate removing all animal products from our daily intake. Since its publication, The China Study has gone on to become one of the best-selling books about nutrition in this country, around 3 million copies. And you can make the argument that it helped move veganism out of the fringe into the American mainstream. Today, veganism is in restaurants, it's in grocery stores, even medical centers as a way to mitigate diseases. T. Colin Campbell is giving a presentation in Rochester. It's sold out tonight, but fortunately for us, he is here now, setting aside time to join us on Connections. It's great to have you, Dr. Campbell. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And Ted Barnett is here, head of the Rochester Area Vegan Society. Ted is so interested in veganism, he's even got veganism and jazz piano.
Right. So, and don't forget, I'm also the founder and medical director of Rochester Lifestyle Medicine, which is, yeah. And we don't use the word vegan so much when we're talking medical.
But no.
We try, yeah.
No, I joke about jazz piano. Ted was saying that tonight you've got dinner, you've got this event with Colin Campbell, and it is all sold out tonight,
It
right?
is all sold out.
Even the even the vegan jazz piano is sold out.
Especially the vegan jazz piano. Exactly.
We're going to be talking this hour with Colin Campbell about his work, I think, since the China Study, but also now as we look at what holism is. And the event tonight, the name is Nutritionism versus Holism, the Case for a New Medical Paradigm. We're going to be talking about really reductionism, which is what Colin uses. But Ted, when we hear the term nutritionism, Michael Pollan, for example, has written about it. What, in your mind, what's the short definition of nutritionism?
So nutritionism is when we think about one nutrient at a time. For example, vitamin C. And, you know, Linus Pauling was all about vitamin C, and if you just took a lot of vitamin C, your colds would go away. It's as if somehow we can influence this incredibly complex system of thousands of enzymes and tens of thousands of nutrients, and we can influence by changing one at a time. And what we have learned is that we can't do that. It doesn't work. And we often have outcomes that are contrary to what we would expect. They're often paradoxical.
And so, Colin, how would you define holism as opposed to reductionism or nutritionism? What is holism?
Well, I made an attempt to define that in the book Whole that was published in 2013. And basically, it is, as Ted says, I totally agree, that it's everything working together. And when I say everything, I'm not talking about just 30 or 40 or 50 nutrients. I'm actually talking about probably, you know, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of chemicals in food, that many of which can act nutrient-like. So I mean, the complexity is almost infinite.
Well, now I feel totally ill-equipped to put together a daily food intake because I can't understand millions of chemicals. But you're saying you don't need to.
It's just
a different mindset as opposed to fixating on, as Ted said before the hour began, protein, or vitamin C, vitamin C. It's the whole picture?
Absolutely. I mean, when we fixate on one thing at a time, we end up putting numbers on how much we should consume. We label foods, of course, according to specific nutrient contents. Not that that's useless. It's helpful, you know, in many ways. But I just only mention that because we're so fixated, you know, publicly and professionally on this idea that nutrition is something about each individual nutrient. You know, and then we kind of add all that up, in a sense, subconsciously and maybe on our minds, when in reality, all we need to do is choose the food that contains the right nutrients. That's the main point. Let the body do the rest of the work.
And Colin, I think, I wonder if you agree, we might become fixated on a single nutrient at a time. We also become fearful of certain concepts almost to our own detriment. I look at, over the years, we see fads come in and out. Gluten is a big one. Do we become fixated and almost fearful about what we're putting in our
body? Yeah, absolutely. That's a product, an unwelcome product of the whole idea of reductionism, where we're thinking about one thing at a time. Because once we sort of fixate on these one thing at a time kind of idea, then everybody can choose their one thing, in a sense, and make a story about it. So, and that's really what, in my mind, leads to this enormous confusion about the concept of nutrition itself in the public. You know, we got to get away from that kind of thinking and just simply start talking about, in general, what is the food that we should be consuming.
Talking to Colin Campbell, a professor emeritus of nutritional biochemistry at Cornell University and co-author of The China Study, and I kind of want to take it back a little bit here, even well before the China study, if we could, Colin. I mean, you go back and kind of tell me how your work went in this direction. You did not grow up avoiding animal-based products, right?
I did not. I was on a dairy farm milking cows.
Yes.
And, as my family did for many generations before me. I mean, I'm from a farm family, and I was the first to go to college, first, obviously, to go to graduate school later on. So for me, it was just kind of a journey, just getting educated and enjoying the science. I'm in science. That's what I liked. And when I got into it, ironically, my graduate work at Cornell University, my thesis was really on how to produce animal protein, the high-quality stuff, to produce animal protein more efficiently. That's where I came from. So my personal background, my professional background started on that footing.
And what did you learn putting that thesis together?
Well, at that time, I accepted, the information like all my colleagues did. I thought that was important very clearly. Milk was a good source of protein, obviously. Milk and meat and eggs, and we all knew that. But then later, when I got my first faculty position at the Virginia Tech in biochemistry, I joined my senior colleague to go to the Philippines to organize a national program in feeding malnourished children. And there, the objective was, in part, to make sure these children got enough protein, like we do in the West, because they were short on protein, so we thought. There I happened to have seen something really odd, namely that the few families who sort of consume levels of protein more or less like we do, those few families were the ones more likely to have children who were more susceptible to getting a certain kind of cancer, liver cancer. And so it meant more protein, more cancer. And I learned it on a golf course, so I didn't take it too seriously, but it registered. And then about that same time, a group out of India did some experimental animal research showing that high protein does increase the growth of this kind of tumor in those animals. That was the basis for my subsequent career for the next 20 years, 30 years, because we got a laboratory, I got generous funding from NIH all during that time, and I wanted to find out, is it really true that high protein can actually increase the development of cancer? And that was very exciting because we went through the years and not only learned that it was true, we learned a great deal about how cancer works. All the mechanisms of cancer. And we were asking questions like, if this protein effect is real, what is the mechanism? So I was doing reductionist research, by the way, not knowing it, not even knowing the word. I mean, focused just on protein and trying to find on exactly the mechanism responsible for this effect and the outcome being one outcome. So that was, let's call it reductionism. When I got into research, I discovered, for example, that the high-protein diet, yes, it did have an effect. It was really major, unlike anything that I was aware of, or I think since then, any other nutrient, what it can do to cancer. And so I wanted to understand the mechanism. So we started looking for mechanisms, which enzyme, which reaction, which this, which that. And every time we looked for one, we found one. And all of a sudden, I'm saying to myself, I can't put my finger on what is the key mechanism. And finally, it dawned on me that maybe there's no such thing as a key mechanism. Everything's working together. And that led to testing other nutrients and other kinds of cancers. And the whole thing just sort of blossomed in various and sundry directions when I finally obviously began to realize that, the number of nutrients are almost infinite, or nutrient-like chemicals are infinite. The number of mechanisms, we can't even imagine that complexity. And a number of outcomes. So in many ways, what my work really ended up being about was a challenge to the way we think, indeed, in medicine. In the present day, we tend to create health, maintain health, we will prevent disease, primarily on the basis of using this chemical or that chemical, we call them drugs. And that's the paradigm within which we live. When in reality, when we stand back and look at nutrition and see it's a very comprehensive effect that all comes down to whole foods, that's when we wrote the China study, that's what really impressed me, that there's a lot of diseases involved in this. There's a lot of nutrients involved in it. There's lots of mechanisms, so forth and so on. So in the China study, that's what I was putting forth. You know, this has a very grand, comprehensive, if you will, and major kind of effect occurring within a very short period of time. And so if I can go on, the China study, I was venturing a little bit, admittedly. I was pretty confident that the story that we told was right.
2005, by the way.
It was 2005.
Let me back it up and just remind our listeners, if you don't know what the China study is, what was it, Dr. Campbell?
The China study was published, as you said, in 2005, and it was an account, essentially, of my career in research. And one part of this, the book was what I just described, the experimental laboratory animal stuff. You know, all the details and mechanisms and just theoretical kind of considerations. And then I had a chance in 1980 to join my Chinese colleagues to do a research study in China on a very large population there of humans, obviously. And in that case, the book recounts, you know, what we learned in China, more or less. And so it was two sets of data that really began to shape my opinion, and it was the experimental, theoretical, laboratory-based kinds of stuff, ours as well as other work from elsewhere, that joined with what we were seeing in the population of China. And the two went together like hand and glove, in my view. And the population in China that we were studying was in rural China, where they were mostly consuming nearly plant-based foods. Not an ideal diet in that setting, because it was still a reasonably poor area in rural China. So they didn't have the comprehensive, you know, collection of different kinds of foods necessarily. So they had some difficulties that way. But in any case, that combination of the theoretical together with the population-based study in China, that made a story.
And there is this viewpoint, I think, in at least some parts of our community, that the China study helped move veganism, I think, into the mainstream more, that the overarching message was that plant-based diet, and we can talk about whether you like the word diet or veganism in a moment, but a plant-based diet works or is effective not only at preventing disease but actually mitigating disease, and that this was the book that helped move that into more of sort of a commonly accepted currency. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I've been told that many times, and I do. But I think one of the reasons that it did have the success that it did have was not only because it works. In other words, the idea sold itself. We go out and sort of make some suggestions. This is very broad-based and so forth and so on. People got the book and found it works. And then the second part of the book that was for me at the time a little bit of a surprise, I guess, when we marketed the manuscript, and that was our book was referenced. Heavily referenced. We had something like 750 references. First, these are primary references where, you know, that's my background. I was really anxious to make this argument, good or bad, on the basis of the science. I'm in science, and I'm a very, very passionate, you know, about ideas like this being based on fundamentally good science. So I wanted to have all the references. People could go back and see whether or not what we were saying is true or not. And when we started marketing the book, I was told that don't put all those references in there because none of the books prior to that had references. and we went through some couple of companies actually offered an advance, but they wanted me to do it according to their recipe, if it were.
Sure.
And I didn't want to do that. And so I wanted to stick to our guns.
And stick to the science.
Yeah, this is based on science. And that is really, in large measure, so I've heard over the years, that really has accounted for the fact that the China study's success because it was different.
Well, and Dr. Barnett, when you have that much actual reference and scientific backing to an idea, I think it's vital because how many doctors do we hear today? And this is not to indict the medical community at all, but how often do you hear people today say, moderation, moderation, moderation? Right. You know, you can eat meat in moderation. You can eat eggs in moderation. You can eat dairy in moderation. And you know, you had to. I think if you're going to come in with the China study and some of the messages, don't you think the science is a helpful supporting foundation there?
Yeah, the references are critical. And, you know, one of the interesting things is we can have lots of scientific research, but unless we have somebody who actually does a synthesis and puts it together, the information just stays out there and nobody acts on it. And that's kind of, I mean, we've known about reversing heart disease since 1990 when Dean Ornish published his studies, but we didn't change anything because you need someone to go out there and do the synthesis. So you have people like Dr. Campbell and Dr. Michael Greger, who Dr. Greger especially doesn't do any primary research at all, but pulls it all together. And so Dr. Campbell has done primary research and also has been a synthesizer. But we need people to do the synthesis to get us to change the way we practice. And that's where the new paradigm is going to come from.
We knew lead was a problem for a long time.
Right.
We were still putting it in paint and windows and selling probably lead candy bars for a while. And because the scientific community was testifying to Congress, no, lead's okay. It took a long. It takes a long time, I think, to move, in other words. And that's why I think you look at Ornish and then you look at the China study.
Right.
And if it's based on science, then it gains more currency. Well, here we are 12 years later. It sold nearly 3 million copies. And I just have to ask Colin Campbell a few more questions before we start drilling into what's going on today. When did you change your own eating regimen to stop taking in animal products?
It was gradual. Started in late 1970s. Obviously, my wife took a great interest in this too, and we had children, and she was looking after that. And so we started changing one thing at a time. In about 1980, maybe or so, we started eating more salad, but that meant more chicken salad and tuna salad. And that's the kind of stuff. Then I say, okay, we're going to drop the red meat in part. Did that for a while, went to the chicken and fish. And so finally that came out of our diet. And then finally dairy, which probably should have been the first thing to go.
Right.
But in any case, from a dairy farm, that was a little slower take on my part.
I grew up in a dairy farm, right.
In any case, we did that. And that whole process took about 10 years. And so finally, about 1992, maybe three, something like that, we're 100%.
Well, that's when we became vegan as well.
Is that
totally
right?
Plant-based.
Did
yeah.
you ever hear that? Is that the first time you've heard that story?
That's the first time I've heard your
his progression?
Yeah, your pathway.
Interesting.
But,
And so, Colin, having grown up on a dairy farm with that background, did any family member say to you, you can't throw out dairy. Come on, man.
No, because, the boss is in the kitchen. And she's the one that fixed the food.
Right.
I ate what she made.
Now, how about with friends? I mean, did anybody say, you're a great guy, but you're a real drag at dinner parties? This whole, no animal products.
I don't hear that quite that way. But dinner parties became less. In a sense, because people were saying, I don't know what to feed you guys.
You get fewer invitations.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it works.
It is very different today, though, and I know Dr. Barnett has made a point on this program in the past, and I'll just stress it again as someone who admires that kind of ethos, that everybody I talk to who moves in this direction of a plant-based lifestyle says it's easier than I thought it would be, and especially now. There are restaurants. I mean, in the 1980s and 1990, when you were changing in 1992, it was a lot harder to find restaurants, meal plants, purple carrots of the world, those kinds of things. A lot's changed, right, Ted?
Definitely things have changed. And it's gotten a lot easier. You call the airlines now and you tell them you want a vegetarian meal and they say, you want vegan, you want Asian.
Airlines?
Yeah.
Not United, though.
I actually don't know.
Okay. Just kidding, United.
But
sue me.
The only time you... Well, so
we
now,
just had a really good pledge drive. We're doing really well.
The only time you get food on airlines now is overseas anyway, so... But.
Okay, so that has all changed tremendously in 25 years since both Ted and Colin made this change. And so now, Colin, are you still doing the kind of work that says we should redefine nutrition or, how we think of nutrition? I mean, what are you working on now?
Well, fortunately, we have a pretty good-sized family, and there's actually now there's 20, there's going to be 21 in our family, counting our children, grandchildren, and so forth. And as I said, the cook is in the kitchen.
The boss is in the kitchen.
She's kind of looked after all of us, and 100% of us eat this way, really. There's a couple we'll skim a little bit now and again, but we do that. And so also at the same time, I've got a couple of sons who have become very active in the field. That's their careers. One of them has been on your show. Physician here in Rochester, Tom.
Yes.
And the other, Nelson, has the oldest, he was trained in government and economics, actually, at Cornell. So he's taken an interest in that side of things. And he actually is the producer of director of a new film called Plant Pure Nation. He also has worked in the sort of for-profit side, in a sense, to makes this available to the public. And so he's got a line of food. It's Amazon has just picked up now as our new partners, and it's very exciting. And so he's organized this a network of about 450 wellness groups here and abroad that are going to be working to convey this information to the public. So, and Tom, in turn, is at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Is that story you know? Is,
absolutely.
And we're very excited for what that opportunity is too, especially in the area of research, because I'm a little bit partial to that idea of continuing to move the research frontier. There's still some things we need to do, mm-hmm. and some really major questions that need to be addressed.
What are some of the examples at the top of the list?
Again, coming back to my own background, but Tom has taken up this in a robust way. It's on cancer. I mean, heart disease, yes, we know there, type 2 diabetes, and some other illnesses too. There's been some work on them. And there's been some work on cancer, obviously, but not quite the way that Dr. Esselstyn and Dr. Ornish did.
You know, actually disease.
Coming back to right. you know, the cancer, they did a heart disease, and we, Tom, will be leading this charge to begin to look at a question in some depth. Mm-hmm. I can't get into any of the details at this point, but it's very exciting. I think if we could address the question concerning the role of nutrition in cancer, which has been my entire career in a way, I think we're going to see some things there that's very exciting. And that'll, if there's something to break the glass ceiling with this message, that may do it when you're talking about cancer.
How do you feel about terms like vegan and veganism?
I never used either word in our book. Well, for one thing, I didn't come into this game even knowing the words, let alone use them. Mine was entirely science, and so I wanted to make that point. I didn't come into this because of any ideological preferences. It was strictly science. That's what led me. But then, subsequent to that time, and knowing a little bit more about those practices, I have to say the most recent data show that the dietary content of fat and refined carbohydrates for vegans, vegetarians, and meat eaters is about the same, believe it or not. The biggest study so far, in my mind, the most sophisticated study so far that I know of, shows that there's not much difference. And that is accounted for by the fact that 90% of vegetarians are still using dairy, I think, and a few other animal products on occasion. Vegans, in turn, are unfortunately used in processed foods, and much too much. And so, and fat is addictive. Fat and sugar are addictive.
The Oreo vegans.
Yeah, and so I don't want to skate around. You know, I honor their motivations for doing what they do. I support that. That's not the issue. I'm simply saying from the scientific, medical point of view, they're not what I'm talking about.
So you prefer holism or a whole food plant-based?
Yeah, I'm the one who came up with that word, whole food plant-based, way back in the early 80s, because I was on a National Institutes of Health sort of study section, we called them, reviewing grants for who gets grants and who doesn't. And there was an occasion in the early 80s when all of a sudden the idea of antioxidants came into view. Basically antioxidants in plants, and I was the only nutritionist on this cancer panel. And so I was asked to next time we had a meeting, come and explain a little bit about antioxidants. Where do they come from? What might they be involved in? And when I did that, and I had to sit and think, you know, this sounds a little bit like vegetarianism, and that's not what I wanted to talk about. So I did have to, consciously, sat there to think, how do I introduce this idea to my colleagues who are very much in traditional research? And I said, I can't think of anything else. It's an awkward term, but it's plant-based, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And a little bit later, we added the word whole, and there you have it. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of stuck with that.
And I think that's been very important. And in defense of the local vegans, we advocate a whole food plant-based diet, and we are very clear about that, that we don't want our people eating processed food, and we want them to avoid the you know, the
that's good.
The refined products. And yeah, we say, is it a whole plant? That's the important thing.
Right.
Avoiding oils, avoiding refined grains, avoiding white sugar and that type of thing. So yeah, we basically advocate a whole food plant-based diet, and we interchangeably use the word vegan, and we tell people, look, be careful, you know, the junk food vegan, we don't want you living on potato chips and soda. So
junk food vegan. Is that you, Rob Braden, the engineer behind the glass, is outing himself as a junk food vegan? So, all right. So because we're on the subject then, Colin, what did you have for breakfast this morning?
I hesitated. My wife is sitting here across the room, but I have to think. I shouldn't have to think because I do it almost every day. and we have oatmeal, fresh fruit in the summertime. We pick a lot of fruit too, and she puts it in the freezer, so we use the freezer, you know, thaw that out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mostly oatmeal.
Oatmeal with fruit. What's a classic Campbell household dinner?
Oh, there's a number of different things. We've got a daughter-in-law and a daughter who actually have produced cookbooks that we use too, and they include some rice recipes as well. But in any case, I don't know. I just kale and beans is one. Another one we call a Dominican dish after our daughter, who was in the Dominican Republic in the Peace Corps. I kind of like that. It's a rice bed, a bed of rice, mm-hmm. brown rice, if you will. With a nice salad to go with it on the top of it, and a lot of beans, and that's very good. I like that.
So Trey, Ted gets asked this all the time, but what did you have for dinner last night, Ted?
What did I have for dinner last night? Oh man, Carol, what do we have? We had some kind of we had beans and rice and chili. It was a kind of a tomatoey chili thing.
Have either of you guys tried purple carrot, by the way? Purple carrot is like the vegan version of Blue Apron.
Right, I know that. Yeah, we haven't tried it. But, my wife is such a great cook on her own.
Do you need?
Exactly. Yeah. But I had the same breakfast.
Oatmeal?
Oatmeal and fruit. Yeah,
it's,
absolutely.
It's pretty good. Yeah. Colin, have you heard of purple carrot?
Yeah, I've heard of it. Mm-hmm. I haven't eaten it, I don't believe.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, we're late.
I can hear some of my family say, I don't know what I'm talking about. When I say I don't remember what I ate, they know it really well. They just,
No problem. In fact, listeners, if you're just joining us, we're late for our only break of the hour. We're talking to Dr. T. Colin Campbell, Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University and the co-author of the seminal work, The China Study. And Dr. Ted Barnett is here, who has helped bring in and set up this event tonight, which is Nutritionism versus Holism, the Case for a New Medical Paradigm. It's sold out tonight at 7:30 at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. They also have dinner beforehand. It's sold out. But that's why Colin is here right now, because you're reaching this wonderful audience. So let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back and talk about more about what Colin is going to be talking about tonight. And we'll take some phone calls if you want to call in and tell us your experiences. I don't know, Ted, how many people in the world of veganism, to the extent that there's a world of veganism, veganism is just the world, but how many people are more important than Colin Campbell?
I mean, nobody.
This might be it.
Nobody. He's the emperor.
The emperor. Yeah. He's the czar of veganism, even if he doesn't use that term.
He's the Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Of whole food, plant-based diet, and came up with that term. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And let me tell you what's coming up tomorrow on Connections. Commencement ceremonies have wrapped up at local colleges, and recent grads are now in the job market. We kick off our first conversation in a series of discussions with graduates about the job search. Are they finding work in local areas? Can they stay in Western New York? We're looking at teaching first. Then in our second hour, the Gateways Music Festival celebrates classical musicians of African descent. We'll talk about the importance of diversity in classical music. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Just want to kind of put out a call. You heard me mention that tomorrow is the first in our series of conversations with local college graduates who are graduating this spring and looking for work in the Rochester and Western New York area. And we would love to hear from you. Tomorrow we're talking teaching. If you know people who are graduating with teaching certificates, teaching degrees, and looking for work, we'd love to talk to them. And we're looking at other fields as well. So if you know grads, if you are a graduate or about to graduate and you're looking for work in Western New York, we don't want to cherry pick them. We don't want all just, you know, pristine success stories. We want the real deal on how people are doing finding work in Western New York. Contact us And we'll work our conversation over the next month or so. Welcome back here. Dr. Ted Barnett is in studio with me. And he is, by the way, the founder and medical director of Rochester Lifestyle Medicine, which, Ted, for those who don't remember, what is Rochester Lifestyle Medicine?
So it's an organization. It's a medical group that we started almost 2 years ago. And the mission is to promote whole food plant-based eating along with other lifestyle interventions that include exercise, meditation, stress reduction. There's a lot of social support involved. We teach what's called the CHIP program, which is out of Loma Linda, California, which is one of the one blue zone in North America. And it's been very successful. We've had diabetic patients come off of their insulin. And it's been an exciting, rewarding experience. And we hope to see many more patients.
How do people get in touch with you?
So they can go to our website, which is rochesterlifestylemedicine.com. And also they can arrange for a lifestyle an appointment with one of our providers. We have 4 nurse practitioners and 12 physicians who work with us. And all of them are basically have seen the light. The switch has been flipped. And they have all adopted a whole food plant-based diet themselves and really have become believers. And one of our success stories that I like to brag about is Dr. Chad Teeters, who's been on the show. He's the chief of cardiology at Highland Hospital. And he took my course about a little over a year ago and became totally plant-based himself. He's lost 80 pounds, and he's sending us patients. So very exciting.
I know. I hear from his colleagues, and they say he's insufferable.
Yeah, right, exactly.
They say he's wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he's a real believer.
Yeah, that's right.
And he talks to not only his colleagues, but his patients.
That's like the joke. You know how you can tell if somebody's vegan? They tell you.
but important with Dr. Teeters, because he's walking the walk.
That's
if he's
right.
going to talk to patients about what you're going to do for your heart health,
right.
he's doing it, right?
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah.
All right.
That's
so, great. So Ted Barnett is here. And again, listeners, if you got questions or comments about what you eat, questions about veganism or really whole food plant-based diet, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Ted's here. Dr. T. Colin Campbell is here, who is the co-author of the China Study. And we'll get some of your comments in just a second. In fact, let's start with some of the comments that have come in online. Lisa on Twitter says, in whole, Dr. Campbell says there's not yet evidence that 100% whole food plant-based is better than 95 to 98%. Can people do it most of the way? Colin.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tricky question, a little more complex than it might sound. I like to, what I say is that we don't really have the science, in my view, that everyone has to be 100%, 100% of the time for all 100% of the conditions. You know, I'm speaking strictly on the basis of the science, okay? On the other hand, I like to use the concept, the goal is 100%. And the reason I say 100% is because, for various reasons, for one thing, that's one way to get there and then sort of change our taste preferences, for starters. It's just easier to be 100%. And I don't see any evidence that being 100% for anyone is going to cause any harm. That's key. So I like to think of this as the goal, because then I can defend it, you know, to the science, to the extent that I can, and then advocate for 100% if you can get there, but honor the step that everyone takes toward that goal. Mm-hmm. So I just like that kind of concept is the way I think about it. That way I don't get crosswise of what the science says or doesn't say, if you will.
Sure. And Ted, how do you think about that question?
Well, I think what he's saying is correct. But you also have to look at sort of the behavioral issues. And that's what we look at with Rochester Lifestyle Medicine is, well, how do you get people to get as close as possible to the goal? And if you're letting them eat, if they're not letting them, but it's totally up to them, of course. But if they are eating small amounts of animal products, they may have a harder time staying there because many of these foods are addictive, both sort of chemically addictive and also emotionally addictive. If you can just sort of move those things out of your life and just not see them again and not have them in your house, I think you have a much better chance of success.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that.
Sure.
I totally agree.
Right.
I mean, I'm saying the same thing, I think.
Sure.
You know, it's that addiction problem
mm-hmm.
that, you know, we have to wrestle with when we make a change, if you will.
Right.
So, yeah, we're 100%
yeah,
on safe.
Yeah.
All right, very good.
It's actually kind of interesting because what I've observed over the years is how we're all kind of converging with the same recommendations. So, you know, what we just said, it was, I don't think we would have had the same discussion 10 years ago. We might have disagreed a little more. But
all right, Colin, this is from Jill. She says she's a big fan, and she wants to know if fad diets like paleo muddy the waters, so to speak, in advocating for plant-based diets.
Yeah, they do. Short and sweet and short answer. I have actually debated the leader of that movement, or one of the vowed leader, a fine fellow, Professor Lauren Cordain. I've debated him twice, also, the father of that movement is a man by the name of Professor Boyd Eaton, really, behind the scenes, also a longtime friend of mine. And so, you know, good people are just doing that. But what they're basically saying is that that carbohydrate is the problem that we've had. It's not the fat. And therefore, we should consume a low-fat diet. They make the argument ultimately, though, on the basis, this is what we did, you know, in paleo times, which I find hard to understand because the data are somewhat equivocal about that on that point. And so what it ends up being, they're advocating a low-carb diet, essentially, which in turn means, almost by definition, it's going to be a high-protein, high-fat diet. And then they defend that on the grounds that, well, that's what we did in ancient times.
What was our life expectancy in ancient times?
Well, we can't use that statistic very well, because the problem is life expectancy is often based on survival at birth.
Yeah.
So you've got to throw a lot of zeros in there, you get a low number.
No, it's fair. And, we don't have big, four-legged things waiting to eat us when we walk outside WXXI studios.
I don't know where this is.
For the most part, not that I know of. But fair enough. But okay, but paleo, not a fan.
No, I know.
Okay. Thank you, Jill. Let's get Tom in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Two things. Number one, I'm a type 2 diabetic. In the course, we're lectured to reduce the carbs. I was a vegetarian for quite a few years and then kind of drifted back into leaner meats and stuff. And when I bring up the subject, gee, maybe I'll go vegan again, I hear from people that, oh, no, you got to watch your carbs. And I said, well, that's not true. It's the fact that you don't want to eat your starchy carbs, your grains and stuff like that, but certainly broccoli and those type of things really don't add to the carb load. And I just want to get the reinforcement from you folks that a diabetic can be a vegan. And just if he's very careful on the carbs that he does select to eat.
Tom, hang in there. Stay on the line for a second, and we'll let our guests respond. Colin, I'll start with you.
Yeah, first off, when we talk about carbs, we should think there are two kinds of carbs in a sense. We got the refined carbohydrates, sugar, white starch, and so forth, and then we got the complex carbohydrates. Most of the carbohydrates we consume are of the complex kind when we talk about food, really. And my son Tom actually has a nice presentation on that question. He went back and got some data on looking at the rate of diabetes, incidence of diabetes, I think it was, over the last 30, 40, 50 years. And it's so clear, as total carbohydrate tends to go up, diabetes goes down. It's very simple. But in that case, what the data that is being considered in that case is the carbohydrate, the total carbohydrate in the food. And carbohydrate basically only comes from plants. So total carbohydrate content is a reflection of how much plants we're eating. So with the gentleman on the phone here, Tom, I think, just doing a whole food plant-based diet is fine.
Mm-hmm. Ted, anything you want to add there?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. So, Tom, I don't know if you're familiar with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. You should take a look at their website, pcrm.org, and they have had several studies with free-living diabetics and out there in the real world. And if you put people on a whole food plant-based diet and you do not tell them to restrict carbs, they actually do better than if they're following the standard recommendations.
It's really?
Yeah, absolutely. The problem is not just carbohydrate. It's really refined carbohydrates
right. And
also fat and animal products. But if you actually look at the empirical data, which is the most important thing here, you have to look at dietary patterns, and that's really empirical. We find that our diabetics are actually coming off their insulin on the diet that we teach, which is a whole food plant-based diet. Basically, you have everything all that you want to eat. We don't tell people to count calories or restrict portions. And they have whole grains. We don't advocate eating anything with white flour or anything like that, but whole grains are fine, potatoes are fine, sweet potatoes, squash. All these things that we think of as carbohydrates are not really carbohydrates in the same sense that sugar is or white flour. things that are terribly refined. So take a look at the PCRM website, and you can learn more about diabetes, Aaron, or you can give us a call as well.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
One other thing, being trained as a physiologist and biochemist, that's what my degrees are in, there's essential proteins, essential amino acids that humans need, essential oils, but there's no essential carbohydrates. So in other words, can the human survive on a carbohydrate-free diet? And if the answer is yes...
Depends on survive for how long.
Yeah, that's what I'm just. These are arguments that are presented to me by friends and coworkers and stuff that say, "Gee, I want to go back to being a vegetarian." Well, there's no. You got to have protein. You got to have fat because they're essential. And there's no such thing as essential carbohydrate. And I said, "Well, you still need it, So
that's
out there for discussion, I guess. Yeah.
That's where we get our energy from. We are strictly on fat and protein, of course we get energy there too. But it's very concentrated. But if that were the basic of the diet, then we have to suffer the consequences of that high fat, high protein. That's a very difficult proposition.
I think the real question he's asking is, can human beings thrive entirely long term without carbohydrates at all?
No, I'm saying absolutely not.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. Thanks for the phone call. On Twitter, Mary Beth says, by the way, the New York Wine and Culinary Center is having a whole food plant-based cooking class series this summer. It starts in late June. So she's looking forward to that. And here's a question for someone on Twitter. It says, Evan, excellent show. I can do this, but I can't live without cream in my coffee and ice cream once a week. Is it a deal?
It's a deal. Well, I mean, look, if you can get that far, you can probably make it the whole way. Let me address the coffee issue, because I used to always have cream in my coffee. When I became completely plant-based myself, I just started drinking coffee black. And you know what? If coffee is really made well, it tastes great black. So that's that. And the ice cream, there are certainly plant-based ice creams, but I don't recommend them as health foods, though. They're really not, they're not quite as bad as dairy-based ice creams, but they're not health foods. So.
Okay. Colin?
Yeah, as I said before, I honor the step that people take toward the goal. Mm-hmm. And that's not the goal. So a little work to be done yet.
But Ted is saying, if you can get all the way there, we can get you over the top. Carol says, Carol emails the program to say, what are Dr. Campbell and Dr. Burnett's thoughts on milk substitutes? Soy milk, almond milk, cashew milk, etc.
They only share the same word. Mm-hmm. In reality, those plant-based milks, if you will, are plant-based. And it's dramatically different. I mean, it's a different food. I think we only called it milk because that was the conventional term for white liquid consuming most of the years past.
So my opinion about those is they're totally optional. We've grown up thinking that we needed to have milk in our diet. So when we make the switch, we think, we have to replace milk with something. But you don't have to replace milk, and I don't. But there's nothing really wrong with them, except that a lot of them are quite processed.
All right. This comes from Rauf. He says, hi, Evan. I had a question for Dr. Campbell about supplements. These days, many young people are using supplements such as whey protein to build muscle mass. I've been hearing that such supplements might cause kidney problems and other disease. I was hoping to know whether they might have any insight on that.
Well, there's a whole variety of different kinds of supplements. There's single nutrient supplements. There's dietary supplements along the lines of herbs and that sort of thing. And then there are the supplements you just mentioned. Having to do with protein supplements that people use. I don't go for any of those supplements, to be honest about. They're not whole food. And as far as the use of protein supplements early in life for athletes, that's not necessary. I've become acquainted with a number of world-class athletes who are discovering, in fact, that's not necessary. And as a matter of fact, there's a statistic out there that I've been told twice by people sort of in the know, in the National Football League, the linemen who use the most supplements, highest protein content, if you will, the average age of death for those people is around 56, 57 years. Mm. So, they're paying a price. So those who wish to use their protein supplements to bulk up, if you will, kind of thing early in life, they can bulk up. They can get more weight. That's from what I'm seeing. Not personally in this case, but that's not the best kind of muscle.
All right.
I think that's the sense of the field.
Here's Gary. He says, after watching Forks Over Knives, I decided to give this program a chance. I am snacking on more vegetables and fruits and eating smaller portions. After about 2 months, I am down about 16 pounds and my clothes are feeling looser. However, I do not deprive myself. If I want meat or dairy, I will have it, but I am feeling much, much better. Thank you. That's from Gary. So,
the more vegetables you eat, the better. The more fruits and vegetables.
Every time I get an email like that, Ted just wants so badly. He just starts tweaking. He wants to say, "You're so close, Gary. You're so close.
You can do it. You can do it."
But he's so diplomatic. You're saying, you're on your way.
Oh, absolutely. It's a path. I mean, if you're eating lots of good food, you're pushing bad food off the plate, right?
Let me get Joel, who is, I'm sure Ted knows well. Joel wants to write in with a question and comment about oils. He says, can you talk more about oil? People preach the benefits of olive oil and other oil products. Can you have them explain perhaps why no oil? What happens to oil in the human body?
Well, oil conventionally comes from plants. It's liquid at room temperature, essentially, as a kind of lipid or fat. And we switched over to the plant oils way back in the 60s or so, got away from lard and butter, went over to oils, because allegedly they were associated with lower levels of blood cholesterol. There was some evidence for that, of course. But in reality, in the years since, now these oils, we talk about, you know, omega-6 oils, omega-3 oils. We talk about monounsaturates, you know, the olive oils and stuff like that. The omega-6, most of the oil that we're actually consuming routinely are the omega-6 type. That's not good. It's pro-inflammatory. Mm-hmm. The omega-3s, in contrast, are anti-inflammatory. And the ratio of the pro-inflammatory to anti-inflammatory, that's the 6 to the 3, really ought to be around 1 to 1, 2 to 1, maybe 3 to 1, something like that when using a whole food plant-based diet. And in America today, that ratio on average is around 15 to 20 to 1. We're consuming a diet largely pro-inflammatory, using all those oils. Not good. That's one of the caveats we like to add to the whole food plant-based idea. No added oil. I happen to support my friend Dr. Esselton on that particular point because of the pro-inflammatory nature. Olive oil, yes, again, a little bit better, according to some of the research, perhaps, than the polyunsaturates. Olive oil is monounsaturates. Others are polyunsaturates. Mono seem to be a tad better in some of the evidence, but still it's a far cry from what it can be. So again, when we're consuming oils, in a concentrated form like that, we're displacing the consumption of foods that ought to be giving us that energy. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole plant-based foods.
Okay.
That's the issue.
On the phones, David in Rochester. Go ahead, David.
Hi. I took Dr. Barnett's course last summer. I've been a vegan for over a year now, and it's going pretty well. I'm a type 2 diabetic. My A1C dropped to 6.1. I was very happy about that, but it's been increasing this last year, and I'm attributing most of that. I pulled a muscle, and I had a surgery, and to the lack of exercise. But I've also noticed some studies from the Mayo Clinic suggesting that eggs really aren't so bad for you. And boy, eggs have no carbs. So I'm wondering, hold the course, or what's your stance about eggs?
All right. Thank you, David. We got to keep it tight. We're starting to run out of time. Go ahead, guys.
So you're asking a couple of different questions, and I think we should talk about your diabetes, why your hemoglobin A1C is going back up. And it sounds like you made good progress at the beginning, and I'm assuming that's because you were on a whole food plant-based diet. And I think the more you pursue that and avoid animal products and refined foods, the better off you're going to be. What happened to your weight?
Well, we don't have the caller because we're going to be out of time in 2 minutes here, Ted.
Okay.
So just kind of keeping it tight on the question on eggs in general. He's hearing they're not as bad.
Do you want to comment on eggs?
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of the studies we tend to do are in populations, of course, in Western populations like ours, where most people are consuming not a particularly good diet. It's high fat, high protein, if you will. And when we test things like that, like eggs in a sense, the study is, first off, seriously compromised in terms of its sensitivity to detect effects. And also, by the same token, sometimes we see results that we talk a lot about when they're kind of small and maybe by chance, just because of the cohort being studied is not on a very good diet.
Okay.
So I can't really.
And they're paid for by the egg industry. That's the other problem.
That's well, probably so. Yeah.
Often those studies may be. And we're only about 90 seconds out here, Ted, but one thing that we wanted to spend more time on, and we always get flooded with calls when you're here, is eating patterns. And so when you talk to people about patterns, what's the message here?
Well, the message is that we don't know anything. We don't know enough about specific nutrients to really make recommendations. What we do know is about dietary patterns. And when we look at the places around the planet where people tend to live the longest, they are living, getting most of their calories from whole plants. And that's what we need to be striving for, because we know that that pattern works. If we start to talk about individual nutrients, that's when we get into trouble. So it's really about food patterns.
And so tonight, it's reductionism versus holism, the case for a new medical paradigm. If you know someone with a ticket, if you want to key their car and grab the ticket from them, you can get it. It's otherwise sold out tonight, starting at 7:30 at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. No surprise, Dr. T. Colin Campbell, who is Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University and co-author of the China Study, always in demand, and he'll be giving that presentation. So they also have a healthy cuisine tasting in the living room from 6 to 7:30, catering by Kitchen Verde, is that right?
Kitchen Verde, yes.
Which, who should we know about Kitchen Verde?
Sarah, do you know about her, Sarah Goodenough?
I don't.
She's actually in People magazine this month, a local Rochester woman, and she lost 135 pounds, going on a whole food plant-based diet starting at age 22, and is now a fabulous caterer. We have complete faith in her.
And she's local.
And she's local. She's from Rochester.
That should probably be our next conversation.
Yeah.
In fact, we have the Summer of Food coming up, a series of conversations about food. Not always vegan. Ted, don't listen Thursdays at 1. But sometime we should have her. So let's get in touch.
Let's get in touch.
We'll definitely do that. I want to thank Dr. T. Colin Campbell for joining us. I know how in demand you are in your time. So thank you so much for your generosity, and thank you for being here, Colin.
Thank you.
We learned so much from him and Ted Barnett as well. I know I'll see you soon.
Yes, you will.
Thank you, Dr. Barnett. I really appreciate it. Thanks for all the calls and emails and tweets. So much interest in this program today. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely afternoon, and we're back with you Tuesday on Member Supported Public Radio.